Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Every Monday here on Radio City Talk on Liverpool Live, it is Mental Health Monday, and we just discuss, well, all sorts of issues from surrounding mental health. And today, glad to say that in the studio with me is Claire Stevens from the Liverpool Mental Health Consortium. Good afternoon, Claire.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello. I was going to say very well. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
There we go. We got there. Lovely. Claire, basically, well, first of all, introduce yourself and what you and the Mental Health Consortium do.
Okay, so I'm the Development Manager at Liverpool Mental Health Consortium, which is a charity that's been going over 20 years now. It was established by people who use mental health services locally, and it's the champion, really, of the mental health service user, but also has in membership of the consortium a lot of voluntary sector organisations who provide services, support in the community to people who need them.
So what sort of things are we talking about?
Things like drop-in services, counselling, therapy, all sorts of kind of arts-based activities and creative activities that help people. Specialist services for young people, for members of the LGBT community, for BME communities, for older people. You know, so it crosses the board, really, and it keeps people out of hospital and out of secondary care. So it's all about prevention and recovery from when people come out.
So it's a day-to-day thing. It's not when things get desperate.
Although
that is part of it, but it's basically
it's
getting on with life.
It's keeping people well on a day-to-day basis, yeah.
And that must be so important to people.
It really is, and it's getting more and more important because times are getting harder for everyone. I've been on this show before talking about the impact of austerity across the city, across the country, and the impact that has on people's stress levels, anxiety, depression, these sorts of things. And also, increasingly, because services are being cut, there's less places to go for support and more need, and particularly as well with the welfare reforms that have come in, that people are being asked to prove more and more in order to be entitled to benefits. And obviously, if you're distressed mentally, being asked those sorts of things can be particularly kind of debilitating. And we've talked to local people about the impact that it's had on them. And 53% of people that we talk to across the city have lost some sort of support service in the last year or so. And there's just been another fresh round of cuts. So it's really, really critical.
Because to have that support and then to lose it, people are in a difficult position anyway, but having something that they can at least grasp hold of and then to see it go, it's a terrible feeling, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It really is. And people are telling us that their depression, anxiety, stress levels are rising. 8% of the people we spoke to said that they're having suicidal feelings. So there's a very, very real impact in that if you cut preventative services, the impact on crisis and emergency services becomes increased, and those sorts of services are way, way more expensive to provide. So it's a false economy to cut prevention, and emergency services are already overstretched, as we know.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to make much sense.
No, it doesn't make sense.
That's quite an obvious thing to say, but it really doesn't, does it?
It doesn't make sense, and there isn't anybody, I don't think, in the city who can justify why that's happened. The reasons are The clinical commissioning group locally have made cuts to, I think, 23 local voluntary sector organisations in this financial year. And the reason is, they say, that it's central government is controlling their funds locally and they don't have the discretionary power to support voluntary sector organisations. But we say the way that they've gone about that, making those decisions, has been completely wrong and hasn't involved local voluntary sector organisations in the debate and hasn't asked us for the evidence to justify the cuts in terms of equality's impact. The way that they've done that has not been good, and we actually have made a formal complaint today to Liverpool CCG about the equality's impact assessments that they've done recently.
What's the nub of that argument then? What's the complaint made up of?
That they have not engaged with the organisations who have been cut. We've got plenty of evidence and data which we could have presented to them, which they haven't asked for. And when we've seen, after weeks and weeks and weeks of asking for a copy of their report, it makes for very, very poor reading. It doesn't give facts and figures, it doesn't give data, and it accuses the sector of not providing that information when we haven't been asked for it. In fact, we as an organisation do a quarterly report to the CCG, which details exactly the engagement we do, exactly the equalities groups that we see, the subgroups that we have looking at black, minority, ethnic, Asian, refugee mental health needs, women's mental health needs, LGBT mental health needs. And yet they say in their report, we've got no evidence of that.
Well, we've got a statement from the Clinical Commissioning Group saying NHS budgets are under increasing pressure both locally and nationally, with demand for health services continuing to grow. The CCG needs to make significant savings to its budget over the next 2 years. Unfortunately, that means we cannot continue to fund all the services we have in the past. Around 90% of our budget has to be spent on the provision of core NHS services, including GP services, hospitals, community health and mental health. So we have to find savings in other areas. After a review of other spending, we've made the very difficult decision not to renew or to reduce funding for a number of different services provided by voluntary and community organisations, including YPASS. These decisions have not been taken lightly. We fully recognise the valuable role that the voluntary and community sector, including YPASS, plays in supporting the health and well-being of local young people. But that's what they say.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't explain particularly... What does that say to you?
It doesn't add up to me, because what they're doing is... They're saving now, and it'll cost all of us as sort of local taxpayers later. There's figures in a report that was done by Rethink Mental Illness and the London School of Economics, which said that it costs £13 a day to look after somebody's mental health in the community, whereas it costs £350 a day to look after them in hospital. So if you're leaving people without interventions, early interventions that are going to keep them well in the community, they're going to end up in hospital. It's going to be bad for them as individuals, bad for their families, and bad for the local economy. It makes no sense whatsoever, and that's what I'm calling mad.
Now, your organisation is not the only one to see cuts. We've got a list of the cuts here. That, in fact, I think only of must be about 20 organisations here. The only organisations that's risen is Marie Curie, which is, I think about the figures here, 662,000 up to 1.1 million over the last year. Every other organisation, including Women's Health Information and Support Centre, Action for Blind People, Liverpool Bereavement Service, I mean, a very long list. Woodlands Hospice has gone down a little bit. But you think about the cuts here. I mean, you've gone from £85,000 in the year to £21,000.
Mm-hmm. We've had almost £64,000 cut in our own organisation.
And realistically, what effect does that have on
your year? Realistically, it means that we're looking at closing the organisation at the end of this calendar year.
Simple as that.
In the CCG's report, they say that it will affect us only in that we'll have to sort of reconfigure our services, but it doesn't mean that. It means, in all likelihood, unless we get some sort of fairy god person giving us money, that we're likely to have to close.
And what effect will that have on
It'll have an impact that service user voices will not be heard to the extent that they're heard now. So there will be no me coming here and saying this isn't good enough. It'll also mean that we act as a sort of body to speak on behalf of the local voluntary sector organisations, which provide services to people in the community. And that role, that coordinating role, will be gone. Also, we do an amazing amount for public mental health messages. We coordinate Liverpool Mental Health Festival, which is a 2-week free festival, which happens in October. And we will definitely go ahead and do that this October. But last year, on one day alone, we spoke to 13,000 people about mental health as part of that festival. That service will not exist in the same way, if at all.
As a budget, totally, it's gone from 5.3 million down to 3.7 million. Percentage-wise, though, it's a lot from your budget. I mean, I say it wipes you out, essentially, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. It does, to all intents and purposes. We can't continue to operate on the amount of money that we've got left.
What can you do?
Well, what we have done is, obviously, we've put an official complaint, and we're looking at taking it to judicial review because we think that the process that's been gone through is not robust, that the CCG hasn't adhered to best practice in doing equality impact. We also have raised it with the Health and Wellbeing Board last Thursday. So we talked to the mayor, we talked to elected representatives in the city about it. What the council can do about it, I don't know, because they haven't got any money either. But I think that they need to be aware, and the whole city needs to be advocating to central government as well, as to why it makes no financial sense, no economic sense, and no health sense to do this.
Are you trying to find other streams of money? Is there any out there?
Obviously, we will look. It's harder and harder to find money because everybody's in the same financial boat. But there are ways of working together more effectively as a local community and as a local sector. And again, we think that that's something that should have been pursued as an option.
It's difficult with all these organisations that are losing money. Seemingly in a similar position. I mean, you look at the Merseyside Action Play group going from 70,000 down to 5,000. Do you think some of these groups, including yours, have been treated unfairly for reasons or no reason?
I think we've all been treated unfairly because we all can demonstrate that we're doing work that's keeping people out of hospital. When the CCG wrote to us to explain why they'd made the cuts, they said that they're adhering to local policy, which is about keeping people out of hospital. And yet they're doing the exact opposite of that by cutting preventative services. So they don't seem to know what it is that they're trying to do. You know, they're saying one thing on one hand and then another thing on the other hand, and the two just aren't matching up at all.
And in the meantime, or even the short time that we possibly have, you've got to keep shouting about this, haven't you?
And we will keep shouting about it because we know. And the sort of ironic thing, I suppose, is that mental health has never had a higher profile nationally. You've even got the government on side saying that we need to do more about it. You've got the royal family on side saying we need to do more about it. We've got local policy for years and years has talked about community-based preventative services being the way to go because they're the most economically viable and also the least distressing and disruptive to individuals who don't have to, you know, reach the point of crisis or feeling suicidal before they get support. But it is going to get to a point where people are going to be feeling that desperate before they're offered any support. And that... It just makes no sense to me whatsoever. So we also know that youth mental health is an increasingly big issue. And you mentioned YPASS before. In the last financial year, they delivered something like 6,500 therapy sessions to young people. They've been cut by approximately 50%. So the amount of therapy that they can provide to young people will decrease, presumably by about 50%. And yet, all the statistics shows, all the evidence shows, that early interventions, when people are pre-teen and teenage, prevent people from going on to have recurrent mental health problems as adults. So more money, if anything, should be put into preventative measures for young people.
And just finally, what's your warning as to where this will leave the people that you work with on a daily basis?
I think it's going to leave a lot of people very distressed, very suicidal. It's going to cost the city a lot. I mean, the irony is that there's figures that show that the cost of one suicide is 1.45 million. The CCG is cutting 1.5 million, so that's virtually the same amount. If they could keep 23 services and keep one person alive, it would cost the same.
Stark warning indeed. Claire Stevens, thank you for coming in this afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.
Listen to Radio City Talk, Liverpool Live on Monday, and every Monday it is Mental Health Monday. We talk about issues surrounding mental health and basically anything that can help people out and discuss the issues that really haven't been spoken about before. And joining me on the line right now is writer and performer Sarah Emmett. Sarah, thanks for coming on this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, you're starring in, you're writing a show called Declaration.
Yep. Wrote the theme tune, sang the theme tune, that kind of jazz, yeah. So I've made this with Art With Heart, which is my company with Rachel Morehouse, and we've co-made this piece, Declaration, which is about my journey to an ADHD diagnosis in my 30s.
So quite late on, really, particularly these days with kids, people assume ADHD, it's kids.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that we've really tried to highlight is that actually ADHD isn't something that only affects children and young people. quite a number of people who are diagnosed as children continue to have symptoms as adults. And actually, there's a large number of adults who weren't diagnosed as children who did have symptoms, but it wasn't necessarily recognised when they were children. And so they're being diagnosed in their kind of 30s, 40s, 50s. So we really wanted to make something which highlighted how it affects and how it sort of those symptoms manifest themselves in adulthood. Going to work, doing everyday adult life stuff. How does it affect that?
I'm guessing this was evident, or looking back now, this is evident from quite early on in your life.
Yeah, so I've always had symptoms. And we talk about in the production, we talk about the fact that my mum took me to the doctors when I was four. And my childhood doctor didn't know what it was. He just sort of sent her home with the advice of, I don't know, just keep her busy. So that's what she did. She Right. just kept me really, really busy as a child. So I learned as much as I could. I did as many classes as I could. You know, we didn't grow up in a kind of in an affluent area, and we didn't have loads of money. So my mum, you know, had to work really hard to keep me busy. And we kind of talk about how that needs to change. There needs to be more support for parents as well as people who have ADHD, but that support network around you. So for me, you know, my family and my wife and for them to have support as well.
And for you as a child, did you know something? I know you're being taken to the doctors and there's explanations of your behaviour, but did you know there was something a bit different?
Yeah, I always knew I was different. I think we all have our uniqueness, but there didn't seem to be anyone who I knew who was different in the same ways that I was. And I felt really frustrated as a young person. Like a lot of children and young people talk about being, you know, kicked out of classrooms for talking and for disrupting other students. And I absolutely spent loads of time outside a classroom, but I felt really frustrated because the thing with me is that I absolutely wanted to learn, but my favourite question still to this day is why? So I need to understand things. I need to not just be told some information or an instruction or a rule. I need to understand what's the thinking behind it. And so that's really frustrating when you're in a classroom full of, you know, 30 other children and there's one saying, yeah, but why? I'm really interested, but why?
Now, in you explaining it like that, I think that would be very interesting for people to almost find out the workings behind it. And it is just that need for information, isn't it? It's almost the constant need to devour information and use it in some way.
Yeah, my mum describes me as just soaking up knowledge like a sponge. Just I need to know everything about everything. And we really talk about the curiosity, and I think when we think about children and young people, we often think about, oh, they're really curious and, you know, they want to go and explore and do things and be challenged. But actually, as adults, that we sort of lose that sense of curiosity and play. And I think for me, my hyperactiveness and impulsiveness kind of as part of my ADHD continues that. And I continue to be really curious about the world. And I genuinely think whether you have ADHD or not, as adults, we should never lose that sense of curiosity and play and, you know, playfulness in life. But I think that's definitely continued as a thread for me as an adult.
So the show is Declaration. It's on at the Blackie in Liverpool on Saturday, is that right?
This Saturday, which is the last date of our tour. So we've been all around the country and we've been really fortunate that we can end the tour in Liverpool. It's really a sort of special place to us. It's where the ADHD Foundation, who are one of our partners, are based. And they do a lot of work, particularly in Liverpool and nationally, with children, young people and adults with ADHD. And so we're really excited to kind of end our tour with a bang almost. And the performance itself, like, we really celebrate the positives. I think when you talk about mental health, a lot of people think, oh, it's going to be really heavy. But actually, we celebrate the positives and we talk about how I feel like, you know, ADHD is, you know, it can be at times my worst enemy, but most of the time it's my best friend. And I think being able to celebrate all those positives, and it's bouncy and it's funny and it's, you know, it's joyous. And I think we're really excited to be able to bring it kind of to Liverpool to end the tour there.
So tell us about your personal diagnosis and your journey to it later in life.
So I realised there's a huge gap in diagnosis for women and girls, and that's often because girls replicate behaviour. So we essentially hide our symptoms. We struggle kind of behind closed doors a lot more than our male counterparts. And so essentially that's what I'd done for a long time. I'd kind of put on a mask every day and tried to sort of fit in. And when I got to sort of my late 20s, I found that actually I couldn't cope anymore and I was really struggling. And so I didn't know what it was at that time. I just knew that I was having a really hard time functioning every day. And so I took myself to the doctors and he said, look, you know, you sort of tick every box for an ADHD diagnosis, but the road to diagnosis as an adult, unless you're living in the extremities, is a really long and complex one. So go away and think about it. And that doctor's visit did not turn out the way I thought. You know, I went for answers and I sort of left with more questions. And it made me feeling a little bit vulnerable and hopeless. And I think from that, I was really fortunate that I had a support network around me that enabled me to be feeling galvanised to tell that story and to talk about it and to open it up. Because I think I looked for sort of females of my age group who were talking about ADHD, and there really wasn't any. And so there's so much kind of stigma and stereotypes around mental health, but it feels like ADHD is this sort of left off subject where we don't talk about it, potentially because we don't understand it, or potentially because people just think it's for children and young people. But we really wanted to change that, and so I decided to speak out about it, which I think at the time, well, it's still quite a scary thing. You know, I walk into a room full of strangers and tell them about myself and my story, and it's really honest and candid. I think that's been one thing that people have felt really surprised about, is how honest I am about my life and how it affects me, and how I, you know, have coping mechanisms to feel like I am succeeding. But I think it's really important, and I think we do need to speak out more about our own experiences of mental health to try and break down that stigma and those stereotypes as well.
And you mentioned both when you were younger and now the support network that you needed. Do you think that is there now for parents of kids who are going through this, or even for people of your age and my age?
So there are obviously, you know, like the ADHD Foundation are a lifeline for people, for parents, for, you know, people who have ADHD. There are, I talk about in declaration, a support group in Manchester, which I go to, which is for adults, Manchester. And there are those networks out there. But I think what I've definitely learned from speaking to more people and meeting parents and meeting people with ADHD on the tour, a lot of them have said, I just don't have the support. I don't have the support I need. And, you know, people are crying out for that support. And mental health services, their funding is being cut. You know, there's so many cuts going on to vital services that people need to access. And so I think for some people, yes, there is a support. But for a lot of people, even within their family or within the area that they live in, there just isn't that support. And so we hope that people come who have a connection with ADHD to come and see it. But we also hope that the general public just come and want to have a fun night out. Like, it's fun. I have a background in stand-up comedy, so it's like, it's that kind of vibe. And people will come and they'll be able to see someone's story and potentially take away from that an understanding that they can use in their life and their family and their community.
And is it tough doing a one-person show, or are you made for this kind of thing?
I mean, one of the positives of ADHD is that you can talk about anything for any length of time. So I never run out of anything to say.
Hold on, this is the city of Ken Dodd. This, you can go on into 2 a.m. if you want to.
Exactly. but it's also a positive. But yeah, it's quite physical. The performance is quite physical, and everyone always says to me after the performance, God, I bet you're so tired. I bet you're ready for bed. But no, I feel fine. Let's crack on, you know. which is quite good because I think we're having an after show party as well in Liverpool. So Liverpool best get ready for some big party time after the performance. So it is hard, I think, but also I love it, and the audiences have been so brilliant. Like, the set is there's a washing line that goes around, and it's in the round, so it's in a kind of circle. Mm. And on the washing line is lots of things that are from my life, which my mum was really pleased about because basically I got loads of stuff out of her garage that she's wanted to get rid of for quite a while. So there's things from my life in there, and we all sit inside a sort of den. And so it's a really welcoming atmosphere. And so right from the get-go, I kind of feel comfortable with everyone. So I chat to everyone before it starts. You know, I welcome everyone into the space. So it's a real relaxed atmosphere. So I think that makes it easier as well.
Sarah Emmett, writer and performer of Declaration, which is on at the Blackie down on Great George Street in Liverpool. Saturday, it's the last show. If you're going to turn up, bring your dancing shoes. Is it full after party and just keep going into the early hours?
I think it might be.
Excellent. Get down there. Sarah, thanks for joining us here on Liverpool Live.
Thank you. Bye.
That's Sarah Emmett, writer and performer of Declaration here on Radio City Talk. This is Liverpool Live.
Mental Health Monday on Radio City Talk. Tackling the stigma.